This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Svetlana Bedareva, editor of Contemporary Ukrainian and Baltic Art, Political and Social Perspectives, 1991-2021. The volume was published by Ibidem Verlag in 2021. Svetlana Bedareva studied history of art and semiotics in London and Tartu. She has held teaching positions at the University of Americas in Puebla and Ibero-American University in Mexico City. She also taught at Cotwood Institute of Art in London. Her previous books include At the Frontline, Ukrainian Art 2013-2019, which was published in 2020. Svetlana has also published in multiple outlets, and specifically in Space and Culture and Art Margins Online. Hello, Svetlana, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello, Natalia. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure.
So congratulations on this volume, and it's quite an intriguing volume, I should say, not only in terms of the chronology, but in terms of the geography as well. So the chronological range of the collection is from the 1990s and through 2020s. Not only is it broad, but it's also diverse, taking into consideration the events that took place in the 1990s, which could be described in terms of some profound paradigmatic shifts. And the subsequent years entailed a number of other events of different nature. So in terms of geography, the collection also includes different, but at the same time, similar entities, as it was already mentioned, Ukraine and the Baltic state, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And this putting together Ukraine and the Baltic states in art exploration is quite intriguing. Could you comment on the geography of this collection that you edited?
The selection of the countries to focus on in this volume was inspired by the idea to compare the development of art in the territory of post-socialist states and after the independence of this country. So my idea was to see if art took different directions, which similarities, which differences we can record, and how artists interpret contemporary political and social situation in these countries. The point of departure was 1991, as the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And first, it presented some kind of a challenge because the idea behind this book was that after the independence, art started to be kind of localized. following this idea of Peter Petrovsky of horizontal art history, that every space, every region, and every country develops its own art scene, and these art scenes can be compared, but they cannot follow this kind of vertical relation that inevitably emerges as post-colonial relation. So the point was to depart from this post-colonial and to see how art in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Ukraine develop independently. That's why, for example, it was decided to publish this book in the series Ukrainian Voices, because it's rather than in the series of post-socialist and post-socialist politics and society that is also proposed by Ibn Press, kind of to focus on the contemporary elaboration of art scenes in these countries. However, when I started speaking with the authors, it revealed that the topics of contemporary crisis, of contemporary challenges, are inevitably rooted in such topics as identity, such topics as memory, as history, negation of the history or acceptance, uprootedness, language. And this is something that unites the territories and unites the artistic expressions in the all the four countries that are mentioned in the volume. So I think with the beginning of the work on this volume, the focus somehow started changing. And it's very nice because also there was a dialogue between the authors. Mm-hmm. And I think we managed to produce certain discussion. I think I need to mention actually the authors mm-hmm. of the book. I'm very thankful really for their participation because we managed to create this diverse forum of professionals in art curation, art history, who could discuss these particular issues in a very advanced level of and from a very critical point of view. I'm very thankful to Alena Martinyuk, Jessica Zihovich, Katerina Botanova, Vytautas Michilkevičius and Lina Michilkevičia, Margaret Tali and Eva Astachovska for their participation. And they wrote some texts that directly connected to their practice, either as art historians or as art curators. And I hope to expand on their contributions during this interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would like to go back to this idea that you mentioned that your focus on Ukraine and the Baltic states was to some extent driven by this interest in post-socialist territories or areas, as well as post-colonial approach to these regions and to these areas. And you did mention that there are some similarities, specifically in terms of identity. Because all these regions that are mentioned in this volume, they were undergoing and probably are still undergoing some profound changes in this identity construction. I'm wondering to what extent these areas are different, because we can speak about identity formation or identity construction in Ukraine, and the same concept can be applied to the Baltic states, but still, probably some different aspects are involved, and maybe aspects are approached differently in terms of identity formation and identity construction in Ukraine when compared to the Baltic states, or vice versa in Baltic states when compared to Ukraine. So would you comment a little bit on these differences maybe, or divergences?
Well, It's quite a complex question because, of course, we cannot compare so directly. It was the main difficulty of the book that kind of making direct parallels is sometimes impossible because the situation may vary, maybe insignificantly, but it doesn't allow this kind of very direct parallelism. For example, if we speak about the text of Eva Stachowska, who was attempting to map transformations from this post-socialist society in Latvia to in Latvia and the Baltic countries to the capitalist structure already emerging inside of European Union. She claims that that the it's impossible to present all the three scenes as some kind of very different scenes in the terms that at the end all this inheritance of from the Soviet past and all this memory and all this relation inside. Now I speak about the three Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. They all this exchange, even despite some kind of discrepancy between the language, for example, they produce a very similar image that enables now the artistic exchange inside the region. For example, Margaret Tully, in her text about a relation to the post-Second World War past in the contemporary art, she argues that the influence of those totalitarian regimes in the territory of the Baltic countries produced the situation of what she calls a Demnikov's dog. She refers to the work of an Estonian artist, Anastasia Sosunova, who presented some kind of a duality of a dog with a kind of a strange monster who has two heads that do not allow him to kind of to live, to function fully. And in this project, the artist and Margaret, they referred to the situation of presence of Russian community in Estonia. So, and this linguistic difficulty that emerges from this tension. If we look through the lens of all these post-colonial interpretations, and if we think about all this hybridity inside of Baltic societies and inside of Ukrainian society, we might find some connections. Mm-hmm. Of course, in Ukraine, this situation of hybridity and its probably quite negative consequences. Represented itself, it manifested itself in a much more difficult way with the war with Russia, with the annexation of Crimea. But it was like the outcome of the same tensions that are present also in the Baltic society. But all of this, they refer to precisely to the memory politics. They refer to anti-colonial, post-colonial, and decolonial points of view on history and the basis of interpretation in art.
Mm-hmm. So, and there is this juxtaposition of the national, local, and transnational and global in the connection as well. So how does this juxtaposition informs the art in Ukraine and the Baltic states? And how does it shape the art in these areas?
It's a very good question, because here I think the situation is different, because in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the space for art creation is basically European space. So already the contemporary discourse then turns to critique of this presence inside of the European space and the relation to the or belonging to this Central Europe, Western Europe trend, the art trends of because also we cannot speak of kind of this unity of European space and production of art. And in case of Ukraine, the focus is more on transformation of the art scene in order to relate to some phenomena that they are beyond the border. And of course, to reflect on the ongoing events inside the country. And for example, Katerina Botanova, in her text, she proposes this very useful notion of artist as a virus, who is not allowed directly to the system because the system probably is quite dysfunctional in some points. Well, she speaks about 90s mostly, because the institutional system is bulky and it doesn't permit the change. So the artist needs to infect the system in order to produce these revolutionary changes inside of it. So it's basically countercultural art, but something that is inserted inside the system. And I think this precise example is something that remarks very well the orientation of Ukrainian art until now. That artist is in constant fight, or not fight, but kind of struggle with the institutional system. And and this is very particular for Ukraine. That's where all this kind of transcultural, all this historical and post-colonial concerns emerge, because the point of orientation in case of Ukraine is kind of more localized. That's precisely this horizontal history that Petrovsky mentioned. To link it to the Baltic situation is to link it through these numerous connections that are not sometimes very evident.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to follow up on this idea about the artist virus image. In our pre-postmodern discussions, let's put it this way, there was some sort of idealized and romanticized image about the artist who somehow changes or constructs the universe. But in postmodern discussions, we were informed about the death of the author. And it profoundly changes the way the artist is perceived. And I'm wondering, what's this role of the artist in Ukraine today? Is it presented as someone who somehow can change the perception of the environment, or maybe this image is less idealized and less romanticized today, specifically either in Ukraine or in the Baltic states?
I think, again, it's rooted in the discussion of this division of unofficial and official art in before the fall of the Iron mm-hmm. Curtain, and how the dissident artists were seen as political artists. And the notion of pure art was reserved for all this inert Soviet official art, mm-hmm. the decorative art. And conversely, on in the West, in Western Europe, and for example, in the United States, pure art was seen in many cases as some kind of revolutionary art, as the art of counterculture. And I think this heritage is still present in Ukrainian art, because I think that the number of topics that relate to either social conditions or to political situation, they are predominant in Ukrainian art scene. And this is actually something that is expected from Ukrainian art scene. The Ukrainian artist will speak about political situation. And I think this is some kind of flashback to 30 years at least ago. And maybe at some point when the market, the art market establishes, when the institutional system of both public museums, Museum of Contemporary Art emerges finally, or when some system of private galleries will emerge kind of clearly and it will be sustainable in this way, then maybe there will be a reconsideration of this notion. But at this moment, it's very difficult to speak about it. And I think this is quite a particular situation also for the Baltic countries, even though, of course, the processes of institutionalization and the change of focus, they're, I would say, like much more advanced, if it's possible to say advanced, or kind of further already from this post-totalitarian feeling. But I think this is also something that kind of makes a portrait of artists, both in Ukraine and in Baltics. This eternal necessity of resistance to some kind of political political situation or political crisis or political challenges.
And the collection itself asks us to establish some dialogue with the Soviet times, and there are pieces that touch upon the Soviet times this way or another way. And I'm wondering how this engagement with the Soviet past is different or similar in Ukraine and in the Baltic states. Usually the Soviet times offer this profound amount of difficult issues to engage with, and some describe the Soviet past as difficult, some describe it as troubled, some describe it as contested, but we can probably agree on one point, that it has a tremendous amount of issues that ask for some processing. But how this past is processed is different from probably area to area. And I wanted to speak a little bit about how this Soviet past is integrated in the art in Ukraine and in the Baltic states specifically, and how it is reworked so that it is part of our legacy, but at the same time, while being part of our legacy, it can also trigger some responses. At times it's negative, at times it's positive, but at times it's also a lot of silence. And I think this art in the 90s and in 2020 probably, this art somehow asks us to engage with this difficult past. So how do artists approach the Soviet past, and to what end, with what message or with what solution in mind?
If you think, for example, about the project of Estonian artist Kristina Norman, that she presented at the Venice Biennale, the project was called After War, and Eva Stachowska mentions this project in her text. There was this controversy about the statue of bronze soldier in Tallinn, that for those people who installed it in the Soviet time, it meant some kind of the sign of victory. And at the same time, for Estonians in contemporary times, it was already like was a symbol of oppression from the Soviet state. So this statue was removed, and it provoked big opposition of Russian community in Tallinn, which is a significant number of people, and they thought that this kind of it invades their kind of right for the memory and commemoration. And Kristina Norman then recreated the replica of this bronze soldier that she reinstalled in the public space, and then she recorded the reactions of the people in this way, to provoke again the discussion of the right for commemoration and the right of oblivion also. And and I think it's kind of a very interesting critical project that also can be reflected in many examples of Ukrainian art. for example, well, we can think, for example, about this famous project of Nikita Kadan, of this postament, mm-hmm. the pedestal, or which pushes out, which is taking all the room and pushes out basically something that needs to stand on it, like the commemoration as the main practice and as a totalitarian practice.
Mm-hmm.
Or, for example, we can think about reflections of a contemporary photographer, Yevgeny Nikiforov, on the decommunization practices in Ukraine, where he traveled after the laws of decommunization were accepted. In 2015, he traveled in all the territory of Ukraine and was documenting the monuments. They were either in the process of demolition or they were reworked to contain different, more kind of Ukraine, pro-Ukrainian symbolism, or they were removed and hidden somewhere in the barn. And in this way, he also tried to foster this discussion of the right to remember and the right to forget, which memories we need to keep and what is considered also the work of art and the works that belong to totalitarian regimes, can they be considered artworks and should they be kept actually and reinterpreted in some way as critically reinterpreted? So I think that also this makes this connection of the necessity of permanently return to the traumatic memories mm-hmm. and see how these memories actually change our mm-hmm. contemporaneity mm-hmm. and how they form the art
mm-hmm.
Seen in this moment. And actually there was also a research project in Estonia by Gregor Taul, who's an art historian, and he documented monumental works like murals, monumental murals and mosaics, and also stained glass in different parts of Estonia. And then he published a book. And but this kind of work was, let's say, with the intention of rather recollecting than critically reassessing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a bit different project as mm-hmm. The project of Nikiforov, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, by going back to traumatic pasts, artists in some way work through the some traumatic experiences. As you mentioned, artists bring traumatic pasts to their works, and I'm wondering to what end do they bring this traumatic past? What would they like to engage with? Yes, by bringing traumas back into the present, we engage with those experiences again. But at the same time, there is some healing process maybe, or there is some process of working through traumas in order to somehow engage with these traumas in a more effective and more productive way, not just for traumatizing oneself again by engaging with these tragic events.
Yes, sure. Actually, art is precisely this instrument of working with past and processing it and interpreting it. So this is the very process of working with past in art is a process of in a way healing these traumas. So I think this is completely true. And not only speaking about Soviet traumas, but speaking about also contemporary traumas. For example, my text in this volume, it focuses on documentary turn in Ukrainian art. And I actually propose that in the recent 8 years, after all the events started with the Maidan protests, with the war with Russia and with the annexation of Crimea, there was a necessity somehow to document the reality. But this documentation of reality needed to be also a critical documentation and critical reinterpretation of it. So it's like, you know, like merging two impossible tasks, to document it objectively and to at the same time to work with it in a way to kind of incorporate this this understanding. And that's how many of works of documentary art emerged in Ukraine, between the film few filmmakers who work with different short films, between media art, photography, something that is called to create this narrative that is actually a chronicle of the events, but also then to take further this chronicle to the public or to the audience to discuss and to kind of to find the, if not a solution, of course, art doesn't propose solutions, but some kind of vision of what's going on and how to deal with it, how to accept it in terms of displacement, all the stories of shellings in the east of Ukraine and so on, and kind of personal traumatic biographies of people who reflected in this project.
Yeah, it's a very interesting comment that you made about this documentary way of dealing with the current events, which made me think about Volodymyr Vinnichenko's comments that he made concerning the events of 1917. And in his letters, he mentioned that I can't think imaginatively right now. I can't write imaginatively, imaginatively right now. All I can do is just to describe what I see. And I think, yes, Liz, as you pointed out, there is some traumatic experience here, and it takes time to deal with it, and it takes time to process it, and it takes time to put it in some imaginative space. But this very maybe raw way of dealing with it does take this objective documenting or this objective chronology, if possible. But of course, it will also be, always be somehow percepted, perceived through through the individual, right, through the individual lens as well. But it's very, I thought that it's very interesting to think this way about just documenting things the way they are, and it also establishes different parallels between different historical periods, but still it as we see it reveals some similarities. The collection also mentions the notion of freedom, and it's a common trope that artists regain some freedom after the fall of the Iron Curtain. How do you conceptualize this freedom of the Soviet artists who found themselves in independent countries overnight? So is it freedom, or can we say that artists somehow regained freedom after the collapse of the Iron Curtain?
Is an interesting question, because the definitions of freedom, I think, in different texts collected in this volume, they are very different. And for example, Elena Martinuk, in her text about late perestroika art, She sees this change to freedom as some kind of apocalyptic, some kind of eschatological event. And it's quite interesting is that actually the end of the times, or the end of history, yes, if you use this Fukuyama's notion, it actually turned to some kind of new turn for Ukrainian art that started anew, supposedly, after the fall of the Soviet Union. However, of course, we see that this, and even Alena presents this in her text, that this apocalyptic visions, they actually continued through 90s and kind of through this process of transformation, because of course there was no kind of rapid change and no instant revolution in 1991. And I think this freedom in different contexts, even inside the same country, such as Ukraine, it undertook different ways and different versions. And for example, we can speak about the a very rapid emergence of media art in early 1990s. But of course, we link it to the developments also back to the 80s. And but of course, in context of Soviet Union, it would be difficult to develop this this fully. Or I can speak about I would like to mention the text of Jessica Zichovich, who speaks about feminism in Ukrainian art, in contemporary Ukrainian art, and how this perception of woman, of a female artist, a female artist who in a way opposes, subverts the system, tries to change the system, how it became very prominent precisely in the latest decades. So this also is part of this idea of artistic freedom that is actually linked to the transformation inside the traditional society and perhaps some kind of change in the societal structure that leads to this liberation. And so on. We can think, I think, about different aspects of this, of the social, that are linked to different aspects of the artistic.
So there are different approaches to this concept of freedom, and we can fragmentize freedom as well, and it will open up different perspectives on what we consider freedom and what we consider as artists who's free or who liberated, right? I'm wondering if you have a chance to teach either Ukrainian culture to your students, or you have a chance to combine Ukrainian culture and the culture of Baltic states in your teachings, and what's the response of your students?
I'm currently in Mexico. So just recently I opened a course about East Central Europe and the history of conflicts in East Central Europe in 20th century, and it's quite interesting to actually to present and to interact with Mexican students, Mexican and students from other countries of Latin America, in their visions of all these turbulences of the 20th century history. And this vision, sometimes they're very different from what is kind of seen and accepted in Eastern Europe. Because of course, if we think about, for example, as Vitaly Chernevsky called Ukraine post-colonial in the Second World, Mexico was is post-colonial in the Third World. So land is different lands and different critical approaches. Third World in the terms of these divisions back into the Cold War, when there was this First World of the United States and the Soviet Union, the second and the Soviet bloc, and the third world was supposedly neutral. But it's kind of, I see how this historical neutrality also makes effects in the visions of contemporary situation, because of course the perspective is sometimes kind of very interesting to discuss in terms of taking different positions, and sometimes it goes into some kind of argument.
And what are those areas which receive a lot of students' response when you cover some specific topics in Central East European context?
I would like to mention an exhibition that I co-curated here in Mexico City in 2019, mm-hmm. and it was an exhibition about Ukrainian war.
Mm-hmm.
It was called At the Frontline, Ukrainian Art 2013-2019. And we presented works by different Ukrainian artists, such as Evgenia Belarusis, Mykola Rybny, and many others who focused precisely on the displaying the events of the Maidan and the war. And there was a program, a parallel program at here at the Museum of Memory and Tolerance, which was dedicated to discussion of these events in Ukraine and presenting the crisis and also discussing this topic of violence and displacement. And we found a big response from the audience during these discussions, because actually they started making kind of parallels both to historical events in Mexico in 1968, when there were student protests that were violently suppressed by the government, and there were 300 students killed in Mexico City, and also to the topics of gun, of all this kind of drug-related violence in the north of Mexico. And I remember there was one woman who, after one of the panels, she approached me and she started telling her story how she was hiding when she was in some town in Sinaloa. She was hiding under the table of her office because there was a shooting outside. Mm-hmm. And after the shooting became kind of a routine, not an isolated case, she decided she needed to run to Mexico City. Mm-hmm. So the stories of displacement, they make kind of also a connection to in many cases to local mm-hmm. audiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like how this episode really shows how local can become global, and how we can connect local experiences to more universal, probably, and more global issues. And this is a very neat way, I would say, to connect not just different individuals, but different political entities and different cultural entities, so that there is this global conversation and global dialogue. You know, when our experiences are not just linked to some specific local space, it's a very nice way to look at it. Mm-hmm.
That's actually the direction that I want to develop, because I am originally specializing in Latin American and Eastern European art. So to link these two worlds is quite difficult. For this, there is a big need in methodology, a comparative methodology in the history of art. And there are a few books, really few, published on comparativism in art history. And I think this is a very interesting and this is a very important niche that needs to be developed, because through different notions and through different historic and political perspectives, we can also make a link between different artistic practices.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be necessarily direct artistic exchange. It can be even a kind of comparison based on some kind of survey of notions that are common for this region and other regions.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think, given how globalized art is becoming in the latest years, and with all these big art fairs and biennales that emerge worldwide, and they precisely try to make these local histories contextualized into the global context.
Mm-hmm.
So that's precisely my kind of my big interest in art research.
Well, thank you so much, Svetlana. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this collection that opens up new perspectives on art and new perspectives on the areas and regions where this art is performed.
Thank you so much for the interview. It's a big pleasure.
Today I spoke with Svetlana Bedreva, editor of Contemporary Ukrainian and Baltic Art, Political and Social Perspectives, 1991-2021. The collection was published by Ibidem Verlag in 2021. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.